From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Good evening, listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. And yes, my name is Dana Pretzer. Rita Cosby is an Emmy Award-winning journalist. Rita Cosby has hosted the top-rated show on MSNBC called Rita Cosby, Live and Direct. She also hosted Fox News Channel highly-rated program Fox News with Rita Cosby and The Big Story Weekend with Rita Cosby. She is an Emmy Award-winning journalist, and she's written a new book called Blonde Ambition, The Untold Story Behind the Anna Nicole Smith Death. And, of course, you could go to www.ritacosby.com or the link at scaredmonkeys.com to purchase the book. And I am just tickled pink to have her on the show tonight. Hi, Rita.
Hi there, Dana. It's so great to talk with you.
It's great to have you, too. Now, we're going to obviously talk about the book, but we're going to talk about your career a little bit, too. We've got the full hour, lots to talk about. You've been there. You've done that. I respect you as a TV journalist, author. When I announced that we were going to do this show, I have to share this email that I got. Of course, it was from Anonymous, that famous person, Anonymous.
Right.
And he wrote, "No softball questions." That's it. Nothing else.
So, I think that was Howard K. Stern or Larry Burkett who wrote that.
I think so. So what I got to tell you, put your mask on, you know, the catcher's mask and the chest protector. I think that's what that's called. Get your glove ready because we're going to get going.
Good. I'm looking forward to it. And I think, you know, that exemplifies my book. I mean, my book, I think, is a no-nonsense, tell it like it is, the real story of what happened in this case. And I think when people read my book, Blonde Ambition, it really will open some enormous eyes, and I'm praying at the end of the day, maybe even, you know, give fresh looks at the death of Anna Nicole Smith and her son.
The difference between my show and others, Rita, as you know, is that we try to give the guest an opportunity to speak. And in this next hour, you won't be limited to a minute or two soundbite here or there. I'm going to ask you questions, and you're going to have all the time in the world to answer them.
Which I look forward to. That's terrific.
Well, I look forward to that, too. But some of the questions that I got for you before we get right into the book is, what are you doing now? You know, when we turn on, you're a staple on Fox and MSNBC, and you turn on now, and, you know, I saw you on O'Reilly the other night, and I enjoyed the banter between the two of you, and I miss you on there, and I miss you on TV. What's Rita Cosby doing today?
Thank you. Well, I've had a lot of offers, and I purposely took some time off to write this book. And I knew that I would have to take time off because what happened was, you know, I was given a very sort of short window to write the book. We did a lot of research, and I knew that there was no way I was going to be able to sort of do a full-time job or almost even a part-time job while I was doing this project, just because I really wanted to spend time, I wanted to do it right, and there were so many different areas that I wanted to explore in it. So I actually did take a bit of sort of an unorthodox approach and decided to take a bit of a hiatus to work on this particular book, and I'm thrilled I did. I mean, it's been a wonderful different period of my life and an interesting new part and period of my life, something I'd never done before. And I've had offers to do books through the years, Dana, and just never thought there would be any way I could do it. To be honest with you, I just, you know, when I was working, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week,
right.
The thought of being able to do a book or do something else, and I'm one of those folks that I don't like to do sort of anything halfway. I'd like to really spend time and do it right. And I really have focused exclusively on working on this book. But I'll be back on TV soon.
That's great. That's great to hear. I told you off air, and I want to share with the audience, I spent some time with Dwayne Chapman and Beth the mm-hmm. other night. In fact, Dog's going to be part of this program this evening. And we started talking about you, of course, and they described you as one tough nut. Okay. In fact, that's what Beth called you, one tough nut.
Oh, that's great.
And of course, they were very fond of you. And we're going to talk a little bit about Dog the Bounty Hunter a little bit later on. But let's get right into the book. Again, the book is Blonde Ambition. New York Times best-selling list. You and Dog are right up there. That's great.
In fact, I got a call from Dog just before the show, which I thought was very cute. And I was just telling you prior to the show here. He called me and said, "Hey, guess who's also on the bestseller list this week?" So Dog and I are both on the New York Times bestseller list, and I thought that was so terrific.
Now, Blonde Ambition, again, the title, I think, speaks for itself. Anna Nicole was famous for being famous, I guess.
That's exactly how we describe her, Dana, that she was this woman who you kind of can't go, right, I don't remember her for this role or for this role or for this role, but she was larger than life. And I remember when I met her at an Oscars event, she kind of came in the room and consumed the room with her looks and her appearance, and everybody was glued to the picture and glued to seeing her come down the stairs. And, you know, there were a lot of stars at this Oscar event that I went to, and much bigger names and much more accomplished names, if you will. But when Anna came in, there was just this sort of presence, and it was like sort of a, like a whirlwind walked in, and everybody just was captivated by her. And I think that that's the sense that you get sort of through the book, too, that here is this woman who... as Hugh Hefner described to me, you know, the head of Playboy, he said to me, you know, she desperately, desperately wanted to be famous at all costs, was willing to do anything she could to get to that point, you know, and would marry someone 6 years older, would strip, work, you know, do things for Playboy, all this stuff.
Right.
But at the end of the day, everybody I talked to also said she was a real sweetheart and just a very nice person who just sort of this whirlwind got around her of drugs and eventually consumed her.
Is Anna Nicole more famous today in death than in life?
It seems so, and that's sad because, again, you know, I heard so many nice things about her as a person, and these are even people who were, you know, involved in lawsuit and legal issues with her. You know, I thought that that was, you know, that that's pretty interesting, you know, for people who were engaged in, you know, some nasty legal fights, still were able to say she's still a nice person. And I do think people are still so interested, Dana, into what happened, and that's what my book, Blonde Ambition, talks about. We talk about some of the unanswered questions in her death and also the unanswered questions in her son's death, and there are so many of them. And what we found is there's also a lot of inconsistencies, particularly in her death, in some of the statements by people who were there that day, and things that just still do not make sense. If you look at it to this day, you go, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. You know, certain things that Mo the bodyguard, who was one of the people who was there, and Mo the bodyguard came out on one of the television shows and said, well, I was gone for about 15 minutes, and when things broke out, you know, I got the call from my wife, you know, I called her, I called Howard, and then I came back. And what we're seeing now, what we've uncovered, is that there were a lot of frantic calls between the parties. It wasn't just one call. There were lots of frantic calls between he and his wife and he and Howard, and then also calling the hotel liaison, who's sort of their point person at the hotel. There were constant calls. And meanwhile, nobody is calling 911.
Yeah.
And he wasn't gone for 15 minutes. He was gone for over an hour because the surveillance tapes show otherwise that authorities were able to reveal to us. So there's some really staggering pieces of information in the book, some very powerful pieces of information in the book. And I think when people read it, they go, wait a minute, why do these stories not add up? You know, right after she had passed away, the word from the folks who were in the hotel room and surrounding the case said that she had collapsed. In fact, Dr. Perper said that she had collapsed. But now when you look back, she never collapsed. She was sleeping in bed and stayed in bed the whole time, and they knew she had stayed in bed. So the question is, why were they telling people that she had collapsed?
Never woke up, and you're right. Why call this person that person? If it's such an emergency, dial 911.
Dial 911, and that is it's so disheartening, Dana. When you see all the details, you go, why were these calls to all these other people? We see the hotel liaison calling the director of purchasing, the director of operations, all these other players, yet no one is calling 911. No one's calling a doctor. No one's asking what you would think are the first type of things when you hear that your loved one, and now we're finding out it wasn't just that she wasn't feeling well or some strange thing. We're finding out that Taz Breithoff, this is Mo Breithoff's wife, who's the nurse, mm-hmm. who was there with another woman when they discovered Anna. She was sleeping in bed, and they just said, gosh, she's been sleeping a long time. Let me just kind of check on her type thing. And they walked over, and they said that she was blue and purple, had like purple splotches all over herself. And they were just saying, you know, this, and she knew as a nurse that this was a bad sign, that either this woman had died already, which she suspects may be the case, that maybe Anna had been dead for several hours, or that she was near death. And then she calls her husband, Mo Breithoft, who is a paramedic again. So these are not just, you know, naive people. These are folks who understand a bit of the medical trade and so forth. She calls her husband, and her husband then calls Howard. And you can't imagine that after the call he gets from his wife that the call is, oh, you know, nothing's that wrong. It had to be something quite serious at that point. He said he knew that it was very serious. He was rushing back. And then the reaction we also get, Dana, and this I thought was very, very odd. We talked to the boat handyman, and this is the guy, remember Howard was out looking at a boat with another gentleman.
Right.
And they're out looking at this boat, and we talked to the boat handyman who was standing right next to Howard when he got his fateful call. So Howard gets the call, and he says, oh, okay, hangs up, and then talks to the boat handyman for a few more minutes about a paycheck, some money he owed him, a couple other things that he had to do, then walked, it's described to us, not run, was pretty calm. And then the boat handyman said, he said, yeah, I have an emergency, and he kind of, you know, took his time leaving. And now the boat handyman says that was the strangest behavior for someone who got a call saying the person I love is on death's door.
Yeah, exactly. There's a difference in the fame and personality in these two cases, but the death of Elvis Presley sounds eerily familiar to this.
Mm-hmm.
Find
mm-hmm.
him late.
And Marilyn Monroe, which
Marilyn
is, you know,
Monroe.
Her idol, of course.
Yep, and it's that fame issue, I think, that makes the book so fascinating. Again, the public seems to crave this. They want to know answers. As an investigative journalist for all these years, Rita, and covering all the stories that you have, and we'll get into more of those later, why does the public crave this sort of information?
I think in the case of Anna Nicole Smith, people were just fascinated with her because she was sort of larger than life, and you were still rooting for her. You know, Hugh Hefner, I was saying, said to me that she was a small-town girl who desperately wanted to make it big and maybe didn't have the best influence around her, maybe didn't choose her friends wisely. And when you look at her, you're still sort of hoping that she'd get it together. You know, she was sort of falling in front of us with the drugs and, you know, the MTV awards where she's slurring and getting up on the stage. And
right.
There's something still sort of sweet and genuine about her that you still kind of wanted her to get it together. And, you know, you saw this beautiful woman who had so much promise and was just sort of falling apart before our eyes. And that's one case. And then I think the other thing, too, is that I also think the case, there are still so many unanswered questions. And I hope my book answers at least some of those questions, Dana, because I think there still remains a lot of suspicion in both of these cases. And you have to wonder when people are not saying the same type of story, when you look at activities, you know, we look at also what happened right after, you know, right after Anna died, at the timetable of like when she's rushed to the hospital. And she gets taken on the hospital on a gurney, she gets there, and after all these series of calls, she's pronounced dead. It was 2:49 p.m. And then the calls that Howard K. Stern made immediately following that. And again, that just opens up questions. Again, it's just interesting and strange behavior. He calls Alex Gowen of Trim Spa, you know, the sponsor.
Exactly.
She was the Trim Spa spokesperson. He makes some calls to attorneys. He makes, you know, a variety of different calls that just seem a little strange. And then at 3:49, I was actually live on the air
mm-hmm.
with Ron Rail, who was Anna Nicole Smith's attorney, but also was Howard K. Stern's very, very dear friend. They've been friends for a long, long time, and a lot of us didn't realize that in Florida, how far back their relationship went. We sort of thought Ron was sort of an independent attorney. It turns out he's a dear, dear friend of Howard K. Stern, and he's sort of the one who brought Howard into the case with Anna Nicole Smith. But at the time that I was on the air on MSNBC with Ron Rail, and Ron was saying that he specifically, that Howard was speechless, unable to talk. He can't, you know, obviously speechless were the words he used, that just couldn't believe it. And this is when he was telling me that Anna Nicole was deceased and sort of giving the official announcement about everything. Well, we find out now, and this is the first time this has ever come out, that Howard wasn't quite speechless. He was calling Entertainment Tonight, and he was working on an exclusive deal. And you have to wonder, what is going on in this man's mind that an hour after this woman he loves is pronounced dead, that he's on the phone with the media?
Yeah, and that's just totally bizarre. A cast of characters right out of central casting, for lack of a better term. Howard K. Stern, of course, you hear Howard Stern, you think of the shock jock, but this is Howard K. Stern, the most famous lawyer that nobody has ever heard about or heard of.
Yeah, nobody, and also someone who never really made any money. By his own admission in the Florida courtroom, Danny, he talked to Judge Seidlin in that kind of circus courtroom that was going on there, asked, well, how much money did you make here? How much money did you make here? How much? And, you know, one year he said in recent years that he made $12,000, and he said he got that from playing a role in Anna's reality show.
Right.
Because he was, you know, taped during the show. And then he said, what about the next year? And he said, zero. And then he said, what about the next year? And he said, zero. And he kind of looked at him like, how is an attorney, you know, a guy who graduated, has a law degree, have zero? And he said, well, I lived with Anna. Anna took care of everything for me.
That term enabler came up during that circus.
Absolutely. Judge Seidlin actually used that word to describe Howard K. Stern.
For lack of a better term, what does the book cover as far as that relationship between Howard and Anna? And just like you say, you know, you can't survive on 12 grand a year.
No, you can't survive. And that, it seems to be very much, you know, that obviously he was helping her with all her legal affairs and everything else, but he was obviously also spending a lot of time with her and not making any money in the process. One of the other things that we talk about in the book is that in January of last year, Larry Burkett, and this is according to Mark Spear, who's a sheriff's deputy, a former L.A. County sheriff's deputy, that he and Larry Burkett go to the Bahamas Police Department. And in this meeting with a number of detectives, Mark Spear says that Larry Burkett said that Howard Kistern was money laundering millions of dollars from Anna and that he had some sort of proof of it. And that's a shocking allegation. And that he also talked about the head of TrimSpa also playing some, you know, nefarious roles. And when you hear these kind of things and these questions, and again, these are comments that Mark Spear says that indeed Larry Burkett was saying about Howard Kistern, it's so unbelievable almost today that they're now friends and sort of partners in everything. And we also know that Larry Burkett was also going around saying that Howard Kistern additionally played some role in Anna Nicole Smith's death and the son's death. That's what he told me. That's what he told a number of people. And then here he is out there today, again, friends with Howard Kistern. It's a very sort of strange relationship. And, you know, and you talked about, you know, Howard Kistern's relationship with Anna. You know, clearly they, you know, they knew each other very well. They had definitely a close relationship. But then Howard was making it sound, remember, that he was the father of the baby. And that's what he was saying publicly. And what our book reveals is that behind the scenes it was a very different story. And what we're told that behind the scenes that Howard Kistern was telling people that he was looking to go to the Bahamas with Anna to, quote, escape from the father because the father's threatening us, using that language and saying that he was the attorney, very much distinguishing himself as the attorney from who was the father. And that's a very different picture than what we've heard, you know, before. We sort of always thought, well, maybe he thought he was the dad and we're not sure. And now we're hearing, you know, from a number of people who say that, no, he knew he was not the father. And that Daniel Smith, the son, also knew that Howard Kistern was not the father as well.
I have respect for lawyers, but lawyers always seem to be able to talk in, well, I call it lawyer ease or legal ease or lawyer speak. And
but,
I can,
you know, it's interesting. On the stand in Florida, I was looking at some of the old testimony, and Howard used the term, yes, I'm the father under Bahamas law.
I was just about to say that, yeah.
Yes, isn't that interesting? And right, and I remember thinking, oh, that's it. And I, at the time when it happened, I don't know if a lot of us caught his phrasing under Bahamas law, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now we totally understand, because under Bahamas law, he had signed his name on the birth certificate, and what we're told was a second version of the birth certificate. The first one was blank, but that he signed his name. So under Bahamas law, because he did sign it, he was the father under Bahamas law.
Yeah, and I think it was a Larry King interview that I saw him on, and or it could have been Entertainment Tonight, doesn't matter, and he was all distraught, and he said very clearly, legally, I'm the father. Who would answer that way?
Right, yes, and now it's interesting, because now you kind of go, and he also said proud father. You know, he used the term. And the other thing, too, in that Larry King interview, he also said, Dana, that he and Daniel, the son, this is Anna Nicole Smith's son, who passed away, you know, several months before she did,
right,
under some, you know, questionable circumstances. And in that case, he came out and said, you know, he did the interview soon after that and talked about Daniel. And he said, you know, we were best friends, you know, very close, very great relationship, was, you know, very much using that type of language in his conversations. Well, we find out, and we talk about this in the book, that Daniel Smith, according to Jack Harding, who's a private investigator in California, he says a month before Daniel Smith passed away, Jack Harding got a visit from a young, very scared Daniel Smith, 20-year-old Daniel Smith, and that Daniel Smith at that point said that I'm, quote, deathly afraid of Howard Kistern, that I'm worried he's going to do something to me, I'm worried he's going to do something to my mother, maybe even physically do something to me. He was concerned about what he described as sort of laying my mother, which is something that another person also used, sort of that similar terminology, saying that Daniel told them that as well. But he also used the term, he said that I'm very concerned because Howard is feeding my mother drugs, not stopping, not trying to help her, and he said, and I've been trying to stand up to him lately. And he said he did not like Howard Kistern. And we've heard that from a number of other people too, but if you talk to Howard, he would lead you to believe that they were very close, that we were dear friends. And then the other thing that's strange is that when he shows up, then about a month later, after this conversation, this very sort of eye-opening conversation with Jack Harding, the private investigator, he hops on a flight and he goes to the Bahamas. And he's only in the hospital for several hours when Anna Nicole suddenly in the morning, she's laying in bed with her son, and she can't wake him up. And she realizes he's not waking up, and they do a code blue, everybody in the hospital rushes, and he passes away. But he had only been in the Bahamas for several hours. The only thing he did was, you know, he got picked up at the airport. I think Howard picked him up, and then they came to the hospital. Then he was there. Then I think they went out and got some food. he and Howard, because Anna was still in the hospital. She had just given birth to her little baby, you know, right. his sister at the time, so it was a joyous occasion. And then, a few hours later, he couldn't wake up. So you have to wonder, it's just a strange set of circumstances. And one of the nurses is also, reported as saying that she found two pills in the bed that many nurses put Howard K. Stern in. And there's a second bed in that hospital room. And Howard K. Stern on the Larry King interview tried to make a point that Daniel was in the bed. Well, a number of nurses have come forward saying the only person they saw was Howard in the bed.
Right. Right.
And on that bed, when the heat of the moment happened, they were wheeling that bed out of the hospital room so they could make way to treat Daniel in the mother's bed. And in that other bed, they found a methadone pill and another pill. And methadone, Dr. Cyril Wecht, who's the forensic pathologist who did the autopsy on little Daniel Smith, said to me that he believes that methadone delivered the fatal blow.
What is the status, Rita, if you know of the inquest into the death of Daniel? We haven't heard much about that in the media lately.
And it's been delayed. And that's another thing that I think the public needs to look at. As I put all these pieces together, and I hope my book serves to sort of connect the dots, and that sort of was my goal of it, to really spend time and really put the pieces together, connect the dots, take a look at all these different things. And as we do that, we look at what's happening with Daniels, and that's a perfect case. Here it is. It's been over a year, Dana. Over a year. And when somebody dies, you know, a young person, 20 years old, seemingly healthy, dies under, you know, sort of questionable circumstances, it certainly is being looked at by the Bahamas. That was the plan. In fact, the first magistrate who was there was a woman named Linda Virgil. And Linda Virgil started poking around thinking that there might be some drugs related to the case, you know, or maybe something nefarious, and she was asking a lot of questions of Howard K. Stern. And Ford Shelley, who is someone who knows Howard K. Stern, was said that he and Howard K. Stern identified, you know, Daniel's body at the morgue, and Linda Virgil at that time said, you know, I want to come over to the house because I want to talk to Anna Nicole Smith. I want to get to sort of the bottom of this. There's some interesting questions here.
Yep.
And I need to find out. And we're sort of asking about drugs and doing a number of other things. Well, Ford Shelley describes that he's driving back with Howard. And at first they said, well, we want to grab something to eat. And she says, no, we're going to the house right now. You could tell that this was sort of a no-nonsense magistrate. And on the drive, and again, they're in separate cars from the magistrate, in the drive, Ford Shelley says that Howard picked up the phone and said, get rid of the, you know, hide the goodie bag now with the drugs.
Jeez.
So when she came over, she wouldn't see them.
Yeah.
And Ford Shelley says later on that night, the goodie bag fell out of a mattress under one of the beds.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the goodie bag right then and there with all the medicines, all the prescriptions, and the same sort of goodie bag that we heard Ben Thompson, another man who was involved, describe, and also certainly we just heard Larry Burkett describe on the stand in the Florida case. But separate than that, there's all these sort of questionable things. So there's been, then Linda Virgil was kicked off the case. And Howard K. Stern made a point of telling a couple people that he wanted her removed, and then she sort of suddenly was removed. Then they had another magistrate on the case that Howard K. Stern apparently wasn't happy about because they felt he was talking to the press, so he got removed. So now the way the inquest stands right now is it's in a bit of a standstill, and everybody connected to this case is praying that it's going to open up, praying that justice will be served for this young man who yet has sort of a fair airing of the case. And the biggest reason there have been roadblocks in this particular case is because Howard K. Stern and his attorneys keep putting up legal hurdles. And what they've done is they said, you know, first that this, we're not happy with this magistrate, we're not happy with this next magistrate, and then the next comment has been they didn't like, you know, some of the jury selection process, that they felt the grand jury wasn't picked appropriately. And again, we don't know what happened. We don't know if Howard K. Stern did anything or did not do anything in this case.
Right.
You know, that's not for me to decide. That's up to, you know, the law enforcement and obviously courts and so forth. But it is very interesting that he has been putting up all these roadblocks. And if you have nothing to hide, why not allow a fair hearing and a fair inquisition looking into the death of this young man that you say that you loved and you cared about and that is clearly the son of the woman you love? It's very interesting and it's very troubling, I think, to a lot of people. They should be wondering, why are there all these hurdles?
And being tied up in the court for so long, and a guy that only makes $12,000 a year, how in heaven's name is he affording this?
Well, he sells a lot of pictures, and that's the one thing, too. And, you know, I think if you asked him, he would say he doesn't, you know, make any money off pictures and a number of other things. But we know that Anna and he did a lot of big deals. In fact, they even sold pictures from last night of Daniel's life. They sold a whole bunch of pictures of Daniel sort of smiling and showing sort of the happy side of Daniel. And we're told that some of the money from those actually went to pay for the funeral of Daniel. And then separately than that, there are some other pictures out there which are incredibly troubling, Dana.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is another thing that people need to be aware about. I saw one of the pictures, and it's part of a set of pictures from what I'm told, but I just saw physically one of them firsthand. And on that picture, you see a dead Daniel Smith in the arms of his mother, who's just, you can tell, inconsolable. Daniel has tubes coming out of him, and we're told it is minutes after he died. And we're told the person who took that picture is Howard K. Stern.
One has to question the rationale of that, because I have seen families that take pictures of loved ones in coffins at funerals and all that sort of, some would say, morbid stuff. But why that, and what was the ultimate goal of taking that picture?
Yeah, and you know what? He has told people that Anna had asked him, and that may have been the case, but it still seems just so heartbreaking and so incomprehensible as to why he would do it. You know, it just is a strange thing. And when you see that, you wonder, how could someone take a picture like that in a mother's darkest hour? It's so troubling and it's so disconcerting. And the picture is so disturbing, just to see this young boy who, you know, you can feel the life left out of him. He's stark white. His mother is, needless to say, just in total despair. In fact, Anna, I'm told, was so distressed. People who were there, Ben Thompson and others, who at the time were friends of the family, when they were down there, they just said Anna had to be sedated. She was so out of it because her love of her life was this young son.
Absolutely.
And from everybody's account, he was a good kid, a really good kid. And so Anna Nicole was just heartbroken and had to be sedated to be taken out of the hospital. And then when she got home, apparently she was so drugged up that hours later, after a big nap, she came out, saw Daniel's suitcase in the living room and said, "Oh, where's Daniel? Where is he?" And didn't even know that he had passed away, that she was so out of it and so sedated. And then Ben Thompson describes just how heartbreaking it was that he and Howard had to explain what happened, and it was like she relived it all over again.
Yeah, and loved ones are inconsolable sometimes, and it's totally understanding, but again, taking the photographs is about as bizarre as you can get. If you're just tuning in, Rita Cosby is here. The book is Blonde Ambition, and go to www.ritacosby.com or the link at scaredmonkeys.com to get a copy of the book. Now, we talked a little bit about photos, Rita, and a photographer that came into Anna's life is a guy by the name of Larry Burkhead. Let's get into that.
Yeah, Larry Burkhead got into her life. He says that I think he met her in 2003 at the Kentucky Derby, and then that they started dating the next year, and was in her life until, it seems like, early 06. And what we're revealing in the book, I mean, he was on the stand and talked about his relationship with Anna, and, you know, even Howard K. Stern was pointing out that it wasn't monogamous, that there were at least, you know, at least one other person, and, you know, who at first they were talking about, could he be the father type thing. And then Howard was sort of pointing out through his attorneys that there may have been other people, you know, and that it may not have been a very much monogamous relationship type thing. And Anna was known to be not necessarily a monogamous kind of a woman either. But in the book, we also talk about people who said that their relationship, you know, that it was also built a bit on, like, Larry wanting fame. And Anna Nicole at sometimes being scared that he was going to, you know, cause problems for her. The one thing that Anna Nicole was very worried about was anything that would disrupt the potential to get the money from the Marshall estate. This is the big, you know, she was married to J. Howard Marshall.
Right.
Just only about a year or so before he had passed away. And this was the man who was 60 years older than she was. She met him when she was stripping at a club, and the next day after they had lunch, she basically never stripped again. He passed her a stack of money, and she realized, okay, this is someone who's going to take care of me, and I don't necessarily need to get out there and strip again. And we talk about that story in the book. But we also talk about sort of her mindset and where everything was at. And then after he passed away, obviously, I'm sure many of us have heard about all the litigation that took place. And this went through a whole series of courts where, in some cases, they lost and some they won. And in the latest round, they won before the U.S. Supreme Court, which a lot of us followed very closely. And that was a big achievement. Here's Anna Nicole Smith marching and winning before the U.S. Supreme Court with Howard K. Stern by her side. And what it is now is it's basically in sort of a legal limbo, but still up for grabs, where she has the right to do an appeal and look at this case. So right now, you know, it's continuing at this point. And what we're talking about, and I think that's why this is so important, we're talking about huge money, Dana. Huge, huge money. We are talking about $500 million, just a little bit short of $500 million. That's at stake. And that's what the money is that's left in the account. And what we're told that, we spoke with a gentleman named Rusty Hardin. He's the attorney for one of the sons of J. Howard Marshall, who's since passed, but he still works with the family very much. And he said to me, he said, there is no way in heck that Larry Burkhead or Howard K. Stern, you know, who he believes are sort of, you know, working in cahoots right now, too, He said that there's no way in heck that they're going to ever see a dime. And he described it this way. He said, you know, okay, so say, you know, this guy marries this woman. She's cheating on him. Then she has all these different affairs, then has all these different relationships. And out of one of those relationships, there's a baby. Does that baby deserve money from, you know, from this guy that she was married to only for a year? And a guy who gave her, you know, he was saying, I think, more than $8 million worth of items while they were married that year. And he feels adamant. He's like, he is not going to see a dime. Larry Birkin will not see a dime, is the attitude of Rusty Hardin, again, the attorney for the Marshall family. But I'm told privately that, that Larry and Howard are thinking about that and thinking how they can strategize and look after the money and go after the money. And when there's big money at stake, people do things sometimes that they maybe normally would not do.
Yeah, exactly. The critics, Rita, will say that a lot of your book is speculation. A lot of your book is being relied on sources who aren't credible. Credibility is as to who looks at that person as far as their credibility. It's subjective, I guess. How do you answer the critics that come forward with something like this? You know, and I know, that when you put something together, whether it's an investigative story, an investigation, or a book, that you have pieces of the puzzle that you put together, and then you try to answer the questions that are put before you. There's never just a smoking gun and videotaped evidence. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked me that, because I think it's important for people to know that this was a very well-researched, well-prepared investigative piece of work, and that we're very comfortable with what we have and what we've done. And it's important for people to know that when, you know, some of the people who, the person who's really criticizing, you know, at least one of the sources there in the book, and again, they're not my only source in the book by far. We've got dozens of people, dozens. I've probably talked to hundreds of people since the story broke. And I was also covering the case, too, remember. So
right.
This is not like I just came into it last minute. I was very much entrenched in it, you know, from the beginning. But one of the people who's getting barbs, it's no surprise. The barbs are coming from Howard K. Stern and Larry Birkhead. And, you know, they use the term that this person's a wacko, or this person's this, or this person's that. Well, Howard K. Stern was describing Larry Birkhead basically as a wacko, you know, many, many months ago. And now they seem to be friends. And, you know, I think it's important for people to realize when you look at sources and what they say, you have to look at other things they've done. And you also have to look at other people who don't know that source and seem to be saying the same information. And when you put a whole bunch of pieces and you put individuals that we quote in the book by name, which I think is very courageous, we don't have a lot of anonymous sources, which I think is really incredible for a book of this magnitude and a book as explosive as this. We also have a lot of sources that are not in the book, and documentation and information and other things that corroborate what we have. So we're very comfortable with what we have and feel very confident about the information. And also, you know, I also think it's important for people to realize I am not surprised that Larry Birkin and Howard K. Stern are out there throwing barbs left and right. You know, this is what I expected. I didn't expect them to come out and say, hey, yeah, by the way, we are shysters, or we've done this, or we've done that, or we've done these things.
Exactly.
You know, what they're doing is a normal response for someone who's embarrassed by other people witnessing and seeing conduct that's reported in the book. And the people who are doing, you know, who have made these claims stand by what they said. We're in a position to know a number of these things. And if you put all the pieces together, I think it makes a very powerful, very solid case.
We saw court cases in the Bahamas, California, Florida, you name it. It was nonstop coverage. I can remember watching Shepard Smith break the story on Fox News. Of course, you did on MSNBC. It was all going, and Virgie Arthur, the mom, I want to talk about her in a little bit, but the... I say the cast of characters from Central Casting, Larry Birkhead and Howard K. Stern, who were at each other for the longest time. We started after to see photographs of them together. I remember one in a gay bar, some video that came out. All of a sudden, there's a connection between the two that we weren't seeing before. Let's get into that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we talk about in the book is that there was much more of a history than people realized between the two men. It was sort of, you know, led us to believe in court. We didn't really totally understand who all the players were. Remember, at that time, we were trying to piece it all together. And Larry Birkhead said, you know, when he was dating Anna Nicole Smith, you know, that at one point, Howard would even, like, sleep outside the door, like lay on the floor and sleep outside on the door. It was just a very sort of weird relationship. And, you know, one of the people we talked to, in the case of another gentleman by the name of Alex Denk. And he's someone who likes Howard to this day. It's not like he's an axe to grind by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And he said in the middle of the Florida court proceedings, Howard called him and said to him, you know what, let's talk about Anna, let's talk about this. And he said, they're trying to take her from me. I can't believe they're doing this. And he said, you know, remember when Anna told you about how Larry had that relationship before her with a gay male, mm-hmm. Black male reporter? And Alex Blank remembered, because he remembered Anna actually saying that to him, because that was similar, that apparently Anna had also said that to Alex Blank directly, according to Alex Blank. And then Alex Blank said that he hung up, and he realized Howard didn't bring it up yet in the court proceedings, and he was watching the court proceedings and wondering, and it was this big question of whether who was the father, Larry Burkett or Howard, or which one was the... So that's very interesting. And then Alex, you know, said to me that he thought for a moment, and he said, I know what Howard's doing. And he said, you sneaky bastard, is what he thought. And he thought, I'm sure he's bringing it up with him in private.
Wow. You know, what goes behind closed doors is private. We can all think of our thoughts as far as these sorts of relationships, things that go on. But when it gets brought into the public, into court, and it all goes down to credibility, the truth, so to speak, and the welfare for the child, which I think is the most important thing out of all of this, comes the question as far as this so-called relationship between Howard K. Stern and Larry Burkett. I'm not sure how much you want to discuss that, but let's get into that.
Yeah, and that's what's important here. I think, you know, not necessarily the sexual nature of it, but the fact that there was more of a relationship than anybody has sort of realized before. And one of the individuals, a friend of Anna Nicole Smith, said that she walked in and actually saw them engaged in a sexual act. The nannies also, these are former employees, one of the nannies says that she saw Anna Nicole watch a tape of this. Anna was known to sort of look at, you know, sexual tapes and things like that. Again, these two people do not know each other. There's no connection. Right. It's not like Jackie Hatton has spoken to the nanny or vice versa.
Right.
And when you put that together, that makes a very powerful case, in addition to Virgie Arthur, who has come out and said to me, she said that, you know, one day Larry Burkett, and remember, she thought that Larry Burkett and her were a team up against Howard K. Stern.
Yes.
And that the two of them together would be able to sort of outnumber and outpower Howard K. Stern, no matter what Howard K. Stern was trying to do to both of them. And she thought that, you know, he was trying to undermine her and all these others. He still felt, you know what, despite that, we're going to win, and we're going to be able, if we team up together and we stay strong, we're going to be able to get, you know, the baby away from Howard K. Stern. And that was their sentiment. And you could see them even before court in Florida hugging each other and very close. Well, Virgie Arthur told me that they were down in the Bahamas one day, and they're down there, and she's talking to Larry Burkett at the Bahamas Hilton, and she said that, you know, Larry Burkett walked in and said to her, you know, he was sort of, you know, a little bit more detached, and she had realized that I think he was having phone calls at this point with Howard K. Stern, which she found particularly odd, and some other strange behavior. And so she said, you know, what's going on, son? And he said, they're fixing to say that I'm queer, mm-hmm. and that they have proof, that they have evidence. And she said, what do you mean, a tape or photos? And he said, you know, they're fixing to say that I'm gay. And she said, you know, son, it doesn't matter. I don't care about your sexuality. And again, that's not the issue in the book, the sexuality by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, I don't care what the sexuality is. It doesn't matter. I will stand by you, son. I promise you. I will stand by you 100%. I believe you're the father. It doesn't matter, you know, what your sexual past is, men, women, it doesn't make a difference. But I will stand by you 100%. And she said Larry Burkett kind of had his head low and said, I just want to take my daughter home. And she said she knew right then and there that he was not going to be able to withstand against the machine of Howard K. Stern on the other side, and what she believed was probably possibly something like a blackmail situation on the other end against Larry Burkett. And then soon after that, Larry Burkett, you know, was enabled to take the DNA test. Howard K. Stern dropped all his sort of legal hurdles, you know, against him.
Right.
Because that was what was holding up him being able to take a DNA test and be able to prove he was the father. And then Virgie Arthur just couldn't believe it. You know, suddenly Larry and Howard were best of friends, and basically cutting Virgie Arthur out of the picture, which just stunned her. She walked up to Larry Burkett in the hallway of the courthouse and came over to him and said to him, you know, what happened? I need to know, basically. You know, what's going on? You know, did you cut a deal, basically? And she said he wouldn't even look her in the eye. And she said, what's happening with you and Howard? What's going on? And he said, oh, he's just being nice. And Virgie Arthur said she clearly knew at that point that a deal had been struck at her expense.
You know, we've all seen the famous Entertainment Tonight interview of Anna before she passed away talking about her mom. And it was played in court, in fact,
mm-hmm.
In Florida, I believe. And seeing Mom Virgie testify and speak, how difficult was that? You've talked to her as a mother, to go through this whole circus, for lack of a better term.
Oh, she said heartbreaking. And in fact, I asked her about the funeral, because remember, she was doing a last-minute filing at the courthouse, and
right.
it held up the funeral, I believe, by about 45 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And I was in the back of the church there waiting as she was coming and talking to people in the back of the church. And that was a whole sort of circus scene in and of itself. And as she's waiting, you know, everybody in the crowd is getting angry, particularly, you know, Howard's fans and supporters saying swear words about her and a variety of things. And then when Virgie Arthur arrived, you know, it was almost like a Roman Colosseum, because there were hundreds and hundreds of people waiting and watching everybody who was walking in and out of the funeral service. You could just see it. And Virgie Arthur is sort of walking in, and you could just hear the boos. And, you know, it was like, you know, thumbs down when she walked in, because they realized that, you know, what she had done had held up the entire funeral service for 45 minutes for her daughter, and her daughter's body was waiting in the hearse, you know, in the hot sun there waiting, you know, for, as far as we understand, well over an hour at least, because it had come early, and waiting, you know, for her mother to come. And of course she, you know, if you talk to her, she was clearly trying to do filings, trying to do any sort of last minute intervention legally to stop, you know, at least the burial from taking place, believing if maybe she could stop the burial in the Bahamas, maybe she would have a chance to bring her back quickly to the United States and bury her in Texas. That was, of course, what that big fight was all about. But everybody, and I asked her, what was that like? You know, imagine going to your daughter's funeral, and you have hundreds and hundreds of people just booing you and jeering you. And she said she felt like her feet weighed, you know, like 1,000 pounds as she was walking. And she said she felt like the door, which was maybe only, you know, 100 feet away, probably less than that even, she said it felt like miles, and that every step, you know, was just like the heaviest step of her life, to be able to walk in and just, you know, talk about the weight of a mother and all the different issues, you know, because she was clearly having, you know, divided problems with her daughter. Clearly her daughter was angry with her at the end. But it's an interesting relationship that she and her daughter had, because despite this, you know, disjointed relationship and problems, we also know that Virgie Arthur had a brain aneurysm a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this in Blonde Ambition, Dana, because, you know, she had, you know, was not obviously very serious stuff. And a number of people around Virgie Arthur said that Anna Nicole Smith called the hospital basically every day to see how is my mama doing, and talking to, you know, whether it's her half-brothers or somebody else, another relative, but seemed to be very concerned. And when Anna Nicole Smith lost her son Daniel and was so distraught, one of the first people she wanted to call was her mother. And in fact, one of the eyewitnesses told me that, you know, that she said, oh, I've got to call Mama, I've got to call Mama. And Howard kissed her and said, oh, we don't need to call her now. So she actually waited a little bit to call her mother that day. And then when she called her mother recounted the conversation, and she said she, her daughter was so out of it, and basically saying, Daniel's gone, he's gone, he's gone. And then somewhere in the middle of the conversation, it was just a message left on her machine. All of a sudden, it sounded like someone hung up on the conversation. So even though there was a disjointed relationship, she still was reaching out to her mother in some of her darkest hours.
The price of fame, Rita, obviously this... That could have been another title for your book, to see this life that started, you know, in a poor Texas town, to a stripper, to marrying a billionaire, to the loss of life the way that it is. Now we see the young child at 1 year, you know, 1 year old, and the fame, the Entertainment Tonight covering the birthday party and Barney and making it, you know, the schlock. I like to use that term of...
Yeah, and everything's become so commercialized.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, Larry Burkett's come out and said, oh, I'm not after fame, I'm not after this or that.
Right.
And yet now there's some new word, you know, there's a report out there that he's actually, you know, sort of shopping a reality TV show.
Jeez.
You know, at his house with the baby.
Yeah.
So there's a guy who's come out, in fact, in recent days and, you know, and saying that other people are out for fame and fortune, and he's not capitalizing on his daughter, and yet he's shopping a reality show, if that's true.
What's the future going to hold for this child when there's a TV camera in her face from the age of one, from birth? You know,
that's the one thing that's important for people to realize, too, that in addition to, I'm hoping that my book is going to open these cases. Hopefully it'll push that inquest forward once and for all, that we'll be able to see the truth in that case. Hopefully Anna Nicole Smith's, you know, the case, the investigation there might be wide open. Boy, would that be amazing if that were to happen. That would be so terrific. And then separate than that, I think it is important for everybody to think of this little, beautiful little girl who now doesn't have a mother, doesn't have a brother, and, you know, may have two men around her, two daddies, who may not have her best interest at heart.
Yeah, Felix and Oscar, they're not.
No, and clearly not. And, you know, even if you look at statements, you know, how could you, you know, let's even use Larry Brickett's own words. Many, many months ago, and again, I shouldn't say it wasn't that long ago, it was in March, end of March, when Dr. Perper came out, and Dr. Perper came out and said, here's the cause of death for Anna Nicole Smith. Larry Brickett was taped, and Access Hollywood had shown the tape just recently, where he was on tape, and he said, you know, I'm not satisfied with this conclusion,
right,
you know, by the coroner. I'm going to go after anybody who prescribed the medication or anybody who was in that hotel room, anybody who was there. That's who I'm going to go after. And it sounded like someone who sincerely was going to really look into an investigation in this case. He absolutely believed he was the father. And the fact that he is now the father of little Danny Lim gives him basically the only jurisdiction to file a wrongful death lawsuit, because she is the next of kin. Virgie Arthur is not the next of kin for Anna Nicole Smith. When you have a child, the child becomes the next of kin, at least in Florida. So what's happened is, under the state of Florida, Larry Brickett is the one who has the jurisdiction to do such a legal filing, and in a sense be able to sort of pop this whole thing wide open in many regards. So he could be doing that right now, and he hasn't done it. You know, and for him to be months ago in March saying he's going to go after everybody in that room, and now to find out that he's spending time with Dr. Chris Orosevich, the woman who prescribed all the medications, who's right now, as we speak, being investigated by several federal and state agencies for possible, you know, misappropriation of medicines and, you know, prescribing medicines to people who are not listed on the prescription bottle. I mean, so many issues. They're looking into a lot of things against her. And then the other person he's spending a lot of time with is someone we know, Howard K. Stern.
Right.
So here are these two people that he said he was basically going to go after, and now they're good friends. And you have to wonder what happened.
Yeah, absolutely, as bizarre as it can get. And we can all remember O.J. saying that he promised that he'd find out who killed
Nicole. Yeah, the real killer, and he's out on the golf course, you know. And that's the one thing, you know, you look at all these cases, and you look at, well, what are they doing? And he's in a position, and is Howard K. Stern. Howard K. Stern, you know, back to the inquest, why is he putting up these roadblocks? Why does he care who's on the grand jury, who's not? If you had nothing to hide and no issues there, then let the truth come out. Let the chips fall where they may. And wouldn't you want to have justice and have some resolution and some sense of closure in this boy's case, as opposed to a continuing? And then in Anna Nicole Smith's case, you know, here's a great example. The cops and the law enforcement down there had closed the case pretty quickly, and that was also based on the information they had at the time. Now, there's a lot of new testimony in my book that's never, ever come out before, which I think really opens up this case and puts it in a whole different light. And people who were scared to talk before are now coming forward, speaking in some cases to me, in some cases speaking to private investigators. And when you look at these statements, it certainly begs the question to reopen the case. Well, law enforcement may not want to reopen the case because, you know, they have a reputation and they worked hard down there. And again, they may not have known it to begin with the original time. The only people who can really reopen it is the federal government or maybe the state, you know, some different body down there that's over the Seminole Police Department.
Right.
But separate than that, Larry Brickett could file a wrongful death lawsuit tomorrow and have an investigation and look into Dr. Chris Orosevich, Howard K. Stern, the bodyguard, everybody who was in that room. And based on the way Larry Brickett was talking in the end of March, you would have thought, you know, the next day that's what he was going to file. And that was sort of his personality, that he would have done that filing. And here we are months later, and he's dear friends with Howard K. Stern. Just something does not add up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a New York Times bestseller, the book Blonde Ambition. You can get it at www.ritacosby.com. or the link at scaredmonkeys.com. And of course, our guest this evening is Rita Cosby. We've got about 10 minutes left, Rita. I thought I'd talk to you a little bit about some of the other cases you followed. A case that I've covered a lot on my program here. I've had both of the folks on, is the Natalie Holloway disappearance. Here we are all this time later. We talk about lack of investigation. That's probably one of the biggest cases that, you know, just slaps you right across the face. Your thoughts on that?
You know, and I thought about that a lot. In fact, when I was down in the Bahamas, I remember outside the courthouse in the Bahamas when it was this sort of fevered pitch in the middle of it all. And in the middle of it all, I remember a number of reporters and other people down there in the Bahamas said to me, we don't want to be another Aruba, referring to the Natalie Holloway case. And a lot of them were asking, how do you think our government's doing? How do you think we're handling this? And I do think that they were handling it, at least at that point, I thought, you know, much more forthcoming and at least trying to do some sort of an investigation. I mean, we had the magistrates who were at least trying, even if they were sort of squashed within the system, at least there were some individuals who were speaking out and trying on their own, at least to bring some closure, or at least raise the questions in this case. But when I think about when you're dealing with foreign governments, And remember, Bahamas and Aruba, neither one of those countries are that far away from us, but they seem like worlds away.
Yeah.
You know, when something happens to an American in a foreign country, it's very difficult to control. And you talked about Dog, mm-hmm. the bounty hunter. Dog and I knew Dog, you know, before when he was on my show, but I really got to know him after, obviously, of course, he got thrown in prison to Mexico.
Yeah.
And look how much hassle and how many, you know, hurdles and hoops and everything else that he had to go through as a result of that. And that's, you know, what people have to realize, that when something happens in another country, as in the case of Daniel Smith, you know, and unless you have someone pounding the pavement every day and say, try, basically, you know, you're at the behest of that government, and maybe what friendships people have there, what relationships, you know, Howard Kistern's been there a while, Anna was there a while, I'm sure they developed relations, as we know, within the government, too, and that makes it so much more difficult to penetrate. And in the case of Natalie Holloway, you know, Beth Holloway Twitty is truly one of the biggest heroes I can think out there.
Yep.
I mean, she really is. She's such an incredible, amazing woman. And Beth Holloway Twitty, I feel like, has dedicated her life now to try to resolve this. And, I mean, she really is one of my, I look at her as just one of these incredible women to have the fortitude to just keep fighting and bring attention to her daughter. And I don't know how she, you know, I'm amazed at her tenacity, because when you look at what's happened to her, and I had Chief Dompig on, and I know that you guys covered that case so carefully and did very, very well, too. But Chief Dompig was on my air, I remember, when I was at MSNBC. And this stunned me, Dana, here to have a police officer, he's the chief of police, with the deputy chief of police, I think, and he was on the air, on my air, saying to me that these boys are guilty as hell.
Right, yep.
I just have to prove it. And when you hear that from a law enforcement officer, a current one at the time, my jaw just dropped. I went, oh, my gosh, you know, what is he talking about? This is incredible, you know?
Yeah.
And that clearly summed it all up to me, that these guys felt that the other individuals were responsible, that they just thought that things had slipped away, that they maybe didn't collect the right evidence, they didn't do, and how do you backtrack? And even if it isn't them, you focus so much on them. If it was someone else, how can you prove that too? It just seemed like there were so many details that were lost so early on, and inconsistent statements. And at one point we thought like the boys were going to sort of turn on each other, you know, that maybe the Calpo brothers might turn on Yorn and vice versa, and that has not happened. And law enforcement down there, some people have told me that they're waiting for the day that one of those boys slip and something happens, and they can arrest him on some other charge and say, look, we'll drop all charges if you finally tell us what happened, if there is something to be told.
Yeah, we all hope for that to happen.
Yeah, the most important is resolution. You know, I mean, that's what I think is so important in these cases, and that's why I was so determined in Blonde Ambition to seek the truth of this book about Anna Nicole, because I think the hardest thing is not knowing what happened. To have cases where you kind of go, wait a minute, that doesn't add up, that doesn't add up. And the Natalie Holloway case, it is just a horrible atrocity. And the fact that no one's been brought to justice in the case is just almost inconceivable.
Cable news has been doing a good job with some of these cases, but then with some cases, no news is no news, and you don't hear about them anymore. However, we will see John Mark Carr being flown back from Thailand, and 15 minutes about what he drank and ate on the airplane. Yet we have missing people that we're going to follow up on a story tonight that we don't hear about. As a cable news veteran, Rita, are networks, our hosts, whether it's cable news, radio, whatever, are they doing a good job? Are they serving the public the way they should be?
I think some are, and I also think, you know, many of the folks in the business, and you know, including, you know, I think everybody at one point or another, but I think many people in the business also get sort of caught up in just sort of feeding the mill. And, you know, sometimes it's easier to take the shot of, you know, Paris Hilton walking in for the 20th time than to do, you know, real investigative work and really sink your teeth in and to break news, to do news that is sort of untraditional and something that's not on the other channels. You know, sometimes it's just easier to put a nice shot of a pretty woman and just keep running that over and over again. And I think, you know, I think on one hand we are feeding the public and giving them what they want, and obviously we have to provide a public service and keep ratings up and keep interest up, otherwise no one's going to be tuning in. But on the other hand, I think the key is to really find a balance, and find a balance with also, you know, you can do a program that's creative, but that's also innovative. You know, I think that that's important, to come up with things that sort of show new angles and express new ideas and to tell them in a clever way. I remember... You know, you can even pick, you know, something that maybe you go, oh, you know, I did an interview, I'll never forget, with Iyad Alawi, who at the time was the Prime Minister of Iraq, the interim Prime Minister of Iraq. And I remember, you know, a couple of people thought, oh, do you really want to do that interview? He's got a heavy accent. It's not maybe really interesting. Well, at the time, he was a huge get-to-get.
Right.
You know, he was the prime minister of Iraq. There were so many big Iraqi stories, and I really, really wanted to do the interview. And I remember telling, you know, the people I was working with, I said, trust me, I'm going to make this this interview interesting. I did have to edit it a lot. I did have to cover it with this amazing bombing video and a whole bunch of other stuff and try to make it as interesting as I could. That was my task. I felt like if I can make it interesting and fascinating and get good ratings, then hopefully I'll be able to do more of these types of interviews as well. And I was happy after we did that it was the highest rating segment of the quarter, you know, the highest quarter of the weekend. And I thought that was really terrific and really telling to me, and I thought it took a lot of work, but I also was very proud of the journalism that we put together. So I think there's a way to combine and make the stories interesting and fascinating, and not that you don't cover these stories, that, you know, the titillating stories, if you will, that people are fascinated with, but also make sure that you, I think our job as journalists to keep the interest high is make some of those stories that maybe still equally, if not 20 times more important, but try to make those interesting too, so the viewers stick around and get a bit of both.
Absolutely. It's a New York Times bestseller. The book is Blonde Ambition. Go to www.ritacosby.com or the link at scaredmonkeys.com. Rita Cosby, Dog Chapman describes her as one tough nut, Dog and Beth. And I think I threw a couple of hard balls at her tonight. Listen, this has been a big kick for me. I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Thank you. And I'm such a fan of the website and of all of you. So it's an honor for me to be here and an honor to talk to all your listeners too.
And hopefully we can speak again sometime.
Thank you so much, Dan. Have a wonderful night.
Thanks, Rita. Bye-bye. That's Rita Cosby from MSNBC, Fox News, and the author of the new book, Blonde Ambition. Okay, here's what I want you to do. Go to www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you will see a little box in the middle of the webpage where you can sign up for the Scared Monkeys Radio Reminder Service, and then we'll send you special notes about the program, lineups, all sorts of things. So go to the webpage, sign up to that right now. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we are back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and again, special thanks to Rita Cosby for coming on during the first segment. This segment, we're going to talk about the death of a 7-year-old, and I don't think you can get much more of a depressing type of segment than hearing about the death of a 7-year-old boy. So in just a second or two, we're going to bring on Nikki, who is familiar with the case. She's not related to the family, but she is familiar with the case and has been blogging about it. So we're going to talk about Devin Epps. And I'm going to read a little bit from a story here from WYFF.com and ScaredMonkeys.com. This comes from Greenville, South Carolina. The search goes on for the killer of a 7-year-old Greenville County boy. Devin Epps' mother said that a knife-wielding man carjacked her on Sunday. Okay, this story goes back to August 13th, Sunday night, and then smothered her son in the back seat of the car. Investigators said that the child died from asphyxia due to the neck compression strangulation. The case is being investigated as a homicide. Tuesday, investigators were processing evidence from inside the car and following up about a dozen tips to the Crime Stoppers line. The Greenville County Sheriff's Office got a call about 11 p.m. Sunday from a woman who said she had been stopped at the intersection of Jacobs Road and Interstate 85, a frontage road. The woman told investigators that the man approached her car at a stop sign around 10:30 p.m. She told investigators that the man had a knife-like weapon when he got into the passenger side of her two-door car. Nikki, how are you this evening?
I'm good. How are you?
This is a story that before Scared Monkeys covered it, I'd never heard of before, but it's the death of a 7-year-old boy, and there's lots of questions involved. Tell us what you know about it.
Well, like you said before, I do not know the family personally. I do not know any of the people involved personally, but have a personal vested interest just because I'm a mom.
Right, sure.
And basically what I know is exactly what you stated. I live about a mile and a half from where the supposed crime scene took place. So, I've been by there, I've been to it, and, took a look around, and, just sort of checked things out for myself, and it just, seems sort of strange to me. The whole thing seems very strange.
Why does it seem strange to you?
Just the logistics of everything and how things have sort of played out, I guess you could say. A two-door vehicle, at that particular intersection, there's only one stop sign. And at that time of night, it's sort of still, I wouldn't say busy, but it's not desolate by any means. Mm-hmm. Somebody would have had to have seen something.
Okay. And I'm going to share a little bit more of the story here. It says investigators said that the woman told them that the man forced the woman's son into the back seat of the car and ordered the woman to drive around. She was able to get out of the car, but when she did, the suspect locked the doors, and that's when he got into the back of the car, said the sheriff. There was a pillow that was already in the car, and she was telling us that he used one of those pillows to suffocate the child. After that, the woman said she was able to get back into the car, and the suspect ran off into a wooded area. And there's a sketch of a suspect here. That's a lot of activity, like you say, at an intersection or on a road where you think somebody would have seen something.
Exactly. There's sort of a little remote area across the street from the stop sign, and it is literally across the street. So if he had gotten into her vehicle and ordered her to drive, he literally ordered her to drive across the street. And there are several businesses around that area, and somebody would have had to have seen something or heard something. If it had been me and my child, I would have screamed beyond any scream ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing, from what I gather, was heard. And from information that I have gotten from other people that didn't know of the mom and Devin personally, from what I can understand, the car did not have automatic door locks.
Okay.
So he would have had to have crawled into the backseat of a two-door vehicle, locked the doors that were not automatic, and shuffled himself around. And he's supposedly around 6 feet tall, this person that she says did this. So, I mean, that'd be kind of hard to do in a two-door car.
How have the local media been covering this? Obviously, the breaking story itself, but have there been any follow-ups, any questions like you and I are discussing?
I don't think that the media has proposed any questions. I know that we have on the forum.
And just give a plug for the forum.
Have asked questions.
Can you go ahead and give a plug for the forum?
Well, it's GreenwillOnline.com, and there's some pretty great people online there. I also want to say thank you to Scared Monkeys for actually covering the case, because I wanted to see some more attention drawn to Devin's case. It's really a pitiful thing. It's a sad thing. And the media has been very hush-hush about it. They haven't said a whole lot. I don't know if it's because they can't at this point. But it hasn't been getting the local coverage, I don't think, that we would like to see. Any coverage that we get now are just basically the same story repeating itself.
You know,
they're kind of trying to keep it alive, but they basically just keep saying the same thing over and over again. Which is why I did contact Scared Monkeys to see if they could get some more exposure to it.
Maybe some listeners on satellite radio or television that we're also on may not know much about Greenville, South Carolina. Tell us about the city.
It's a beautiful city. It's rapidly growing. We're kind of stuck right between everything. We're an hour from the mountain. We are 3 hours from the beach. And it's just a great place. It's really big. We're the home of, Greenville-Spartanburg metro area is the home of, BMW.
Right.
And we have a lot of growing, booming population, I guess you could say. We're getting pretty big. We're running close with the Charlotte and Atlanta.
So this type of story, this type of death of a seven-year-old, this is shocking for your community.
Well, yeah, I mean, things happen in every city, but this particular type of story where, because I can actually tell you that there have been carjackings in our area. However, A car was always taken. No life was ever taken. And they made off with a vehicle or else money. Mostly, you know, when there is a carjacking, there's a vehicle and there's money. But of course, South Carolina got a similar situation several years back with Susan Smith.
Right.
And this case eerily rings familiar.
Well, we've seen these type of high-profile cases like with Smith and Melinda Duckett that I've covered here on the program several times.
Right.
And the whole tragedy of this is that the child can't speak as far as what happened, and there's lots of questions as far as exactly what happened. If this is a tragedy where this woman was carjacked, fine. Hopefully the investigation will turn into that. But if it's something else, let's hope the investigation turns into that and we get some answers. You folks on the forum are covering this and talking about it lots. I just want to ask you before I let you go, the media is a little different today. In the last few years, we've seen a lot of forums and blogs, and of course the internet. Mainstream media seems to cover more of the Hollywood type of thing. I'm tired of seeing Britney Spears hopping around on stage with no clothes on when they should have been covering a story like this and trying to get some answers, because if the people don't know what's going on, and by hearing about it or reading it or seeing it, they're not going to be able to help. What are your thoughts on that, and how important are forums like yours and Scared Monkeys?
Well, they're very important. Like I said, that's why I contacted Scared Monkeys. I thought that, you know, we needed to get the word out about Devin. We needed a little more national attention, you know, about him. Court TV has also covered Devin some, but I think we needed to go, you know, broader with everything, just because it is pitiful. I mean, this poor baby could not do anything for himself, whether it was a bushy-haired stranger, which is what we refer to him as,
right,
or someone else that took his life. He has no voice now, and, you know, we need to speak for him. And that was the reason that I contacted them in the first place, because I don't understand why he's not getting the coverage that he's getting locally, unless law enforcement is kind of keeping things low-key, mm-hmm, for certain reasons.
Which could be.
I can totally respect that, because right, they're an excellent, excellent division. They do great work. And, you know, I can totally respect anything that they would have the media do. But, you know, if there is a bushy-haired stranger lurking around here, we as parents need to know that. And we would like to see some sort of answers. If it's a carjacker, then we need to know that. We need to know if we need to keep our doors locked, if we need, you know. Or if it's something else, then that other person needs to pay for what they've done.
And we'll certainly continue to cover it here on the program. And, of course, at ScaredMonkeys.com. Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, we'll be right back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show in a minute with Dwayne Dog Chapman, Dog the Bounty Hunter.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
That's right. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. How do you like the new Scared Monkeys Radio? I think it's fantastic. Again, go to scaredmonkeysradio.com and sign up for our reminder service. No spam, no ham, none of that sort of stuff. Just go there, sign up, and we'll tell you all about what's going on with the network. On Tuesday, September 11th, I had the pleasure of sitting down and interviewing Dwayne Dog Chapman, the world's greatest bounty hunter. Dwayne's been on the program before. I think this will be the third time. And then what we did is we ran a little contest, and I took seven school-age kids from my city up to Regina, where we met Dog, had a little private session with him, talked to him, and then listened to a motivational speech from him about staying in school, staying off drugs and alcohol, and how to straighten yourself out. And, of course, his book, the new New York Times best-selling book, You Can Run But You Can't Hide, is available at Amazon. And he and Rita are both on that New York Times best-selling list. And here's my interview with Dog that I recorded on Tuesday. Okay, we're back. It's the Dana Pretzer Show. There's a new book out called You Can Run, But You Can't Hide by HarperCollins. Dwayne Dog Chapman is the author. He's the world's greatest bounty hunter. He's been on the show before, and it's great to have him back. Dog, how are you?
Good, my brother. How are you? Thank you for having me back, by the way.
I'm doing fine. You're in Saskatchewan, actually, tonight at the Brandt Center in Regina. You'll be speaking. I've been running a contest through my show and through the police department I work with. I'm going to bring up seven kids from the local junior high school to meet you. We're going to have a little talk with you tonight, I'm told, and then see your show. But in order for them to have won this contest, Dog, I wanted them to write me a dogism. And what they did, in fact, my son wrote one. I'm going to share it with you if you just have a second.
Sure.
Doing drugs is like jumping the Grand Canyon on a unicycle. You're going to fall on your face either way.
Oh, that's very good. Bring him.
So I got these kids. There's seven of them. They're all junior high, grade 6 to grade 9. We're going to come up. We're going to meet you tonight, and we're going to talk to you because I consider you to be a guy that's been there, done that, and that's talked about a lot in your book. Let's talk about some of your experiences in your book.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, now you go pretty much from rock bottom to right at the top to the being the world's greatest bounty hunter, and I've interviewed your lawyer, Brooke Hart, many times on my program, and I've always said this about you, that if you were to look up courage and determination in the dictionary, I would see your picture, your family's picture. You've been through a lot, haven't you?
Yes, thank you very much for that compliment. That's very nice. Yes, but, you know, there's people had harder times in life, you know what I mean? So, God has got me through every single one. There's always, it seems like in life, a storm, but, of course, after the storm is the sunshine. So I think that's what life has taught me, just to hang in there. It doesn't matter who you are or what you are, that, you know, we are going to have problems, so we better get ready. I mean, it's like putting on a seatbelt. You never know. But that seatbelt is there to, you know, to protect you. So I think life is like that, that, you know, you're going to have your ups and downs, and the ups are going to be twice as great as the downs, but you got to be prepared and be ready for that.
One of your chapters in the book, in fact, it goes through a lot in the book, is your partner, your wife, Beth.
Right.
She's been there with you for a long time. How important was Beth to bringing you to where you are now?
Well, you know, I don't want to say more than 50-50, right? Because she's here and she's going to listen to this radio.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I mean, she is truly my other half, you know what I mean? I mean, that's, you know, people say, Doug, where's your other half at? And really, Beth is my other half. I mean, I love her very much. And we're partners and we're friends. And I think first we're first friends, and then we're partners, and then, of course, we're lovers. But she's my friend. You know, sometimes when the going gets rough between us, I say, you know, Beth, where's my friend at? She's like, your friend is right here, but your wife has left the room. So I'm like, all right. But she's been a very, very instrumental and very encouraging. And, you know, my worst or best critic, I mean, she will not candy coat anything. And she's just, God has given me my Eve.
Starting early, you know, reading the book, which I have, it's an excellent book, by the way.
Thank you very much.
And then seeing an episode here on A&E, of course, Dog is seen on A&E on Tuesdays, where you went back to your junior high school, gave me the idea to bring some junior high kids up to meet you tonight. How important is it to start young with the message to these young folks?
Well, it's very important. It's like, again, let me reference something. It's like getting a flu shot. You know, you want to catch these people, these kids, when they're young, before they've gotten the disease. The disease being the addiction to drugs. Before you catch a cold or before you, you know, get something, there's a precaution.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to catch that cold if you use those precautions. Or, you know, if you take, say, some kind of shot, you know, some kind of antidote for it. So it's very important to catch these people or the human beings when they're young, to teach them that, you know, there's no winners in the drug world. There's no successful drug addicts. You know, there's prison, there's death, there's mutilation, there's pain, there's suffering. I mean, why would someone get in a in a ride, say at an amusement park, that said, this will hurt you, this could kill you, and most of the time will, this would could mutilate your body, this could make you turn into something you don't recognize in a mirror, I mean, no one would get on that ride. And I think that's exactly how, you know, that is exactly how drugs are. And so I think the sign at that amusement park would say, go to the next ride. So that's, you know, what the message that I want to kind of deliver to the kids is that don't even try it. I mean, you know, would you drink battery acid? Of course not.
Right.
And, you know, as a matter of fact, to say that, battery acid is used to make methamphetamine.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you would not drink battery acid, then why would you do drugs? Because it's exactly the same experience, only battery acid takes, you know, can get you really fast, where drugs sometimes takes years to get you.
The book is You Can Run, But You Can't Hide, Dwayne Dog Chapman. Just before I let you go, Dwayne, I'm recording this, but we're going to air it on Thursday night, actually. And my other guest that evening is Rita Cosby.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Tell her I love her and said hi, would you?
And I was just about to ask you your thoughts on Rita Cosby, and I certainly will tell her that.
Rita is one of our greatest friends. Beth and I, our family, our greatest friends. She is, you know, really, really, she was at our wedding, and we love her very much.
Yeah, she's a class act, and I look forward to having you both on the show, even with you being on tape. Listen, Dwayne, I'm going to let you go. I know you're busy. I look forward to meeting you tonight and having these kids I'm bringing up have a short sit down and chat with you.
Thank you, my brother. See you tonight with the kids.
Thank you, sir.
Aloha.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
And we did. We went up and we saw Dog, and it was fantastic. He spent time with the kids I took up, about a half an hour. We took some pictures. We had a great time, and he is a motivator for sure and all the right things. Well, that's it. That's tonight, the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Don't forget the webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. I hope you enjoyed things, and we'll see you again real soon. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.